This week in Retronauts, we wait for the juices to start flowing. No, that's a terrible intro. Oh, Lord. This week in Retronauts, whatever. Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode, 200 of Retronauts, unless the plans change, in which case, boy, is there egg on my face. But here, once again, I am Jeremy Parrish, and here, once again, invading my home, sitting in a small room in uncomfortable, cramped quarters, we have a bunch of dudes.
Ben Edwards.
Ben Elgin.
I'm Chris Sims, and I'm ready to party like it's an unspecified year.
Okay, well, we're not going to party like that year. Oh, wait, actually, maybe we are. But you didn't specify, so I don't even, I can't keep up with you this morning.
Wow.
We'll get there.
Okay, so.
It was my idea to record a little earlier than usual. And yeah, so
we're all going
to
blame you.
I guess it's my fault that this is happening.
It is your fault.
Also, it's really cold outside, so you guys just got to give us a second to like shake off the like ice coating here.
Yeah, we all have, we're all like actually, you know, reptilian. So we're, we need to bask on a rock in the sun in order to get going. Anyway. This episode is a continuation and, oh God, I hope the conclusion of the last episode that we all recorded together, which was the years in review for years ending in 9, because the gimmick is it's 2019 now. So we look back 10, 20, 30, and even 50 years this time. Wow. We went way back in time. And that's why we didn't finish up the first episode. Also because we have trouble staying on track and get distracted often. Yes, we do. And so we're gonna wrap up by looking at the rest of 1989 and 1999 and maybe even 2009. If that doesn't happen, so be it. But this is where we have to draw a line under it, because otherwise it's just going to be like a year's worth of episodes and then we'll roll into 2020's episodes. I don't want to do that. I want to talk about some other stuff. So without further ado, let's get going. And if you haven't listened to that previous episode, you should. It's up on retronauts.com and on iTunes and so on and so forth. You can check it out. It's called Years in Review, and you can tickle your ears with all kinds of information about the moon landing and other stuff. And we're gonna roll right into talking about the moon landing, the natural successor to that, by talking about the moon theme. Actually, I don't know if we're going to roll right into talking about the moon theme. We did, Chris and I and Bob and was Nina on that one?
Yes.
The Disney Afternoon episode? Yeah, that's right. She was on that because she did the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that was only 2 weeks ago. My God, well, I'm senile. So
yeah, it's been a couple of weeks for us.
And it seems so much longer. But yeah, so there is an episode coming out soon, I believe, in which we discuss the Disney Afternoon. But it is germane to 1989 because that was when the Disney Afternoon line from Capcom made its debut on NES. And I don't know. I feel like maybe we should work up to that. Maybe, like, I feel like Nintendo NES has a big footprint in all of our you know, childhood brains.
Yeah, we got a lot in there.
So we should build up to that. Yeah, because it was a big year. I mean, that was where the NES really was just like everyone had one.
Taken off.
Mm-hmm. Looking at the list of everything, it is a huge year for NES.
Yes.
So why don't we talk about, let's talk about NEC, because they also had a big year that year, but it wasn't as big as it should have been. Poor NEC.
Well, and all of us over here were in the NES fever we were just talking about. And then, you know, there was the Genesis competing with it. And
we'll talk about that too.
We'll talk about that. But like, so, you know, over here in the US, the NEC was really this kind of third string. What even is that?
What was the NEC? You keep saying NEC, but what is that? What are we talking about?
TurboGrafx-16. Yeah, so it had these like Bonk ads, and we saw them, but
this is before Bonk.
It had like China Warrior ads.
Bonk's Adventure came out this year.
Here is a very bad game with stiff animation, but the sprites are huge. Yeah. Mario can't do this.
I have a story about China Warrior. I think I've mentioned before, which is that. Well, I should step back and say that we got a TurboGrafx-16 when it was pretty much new. Mm-hmm. One of my brother's friends had one for some reason. And
he was like, you've got to check out this. What the hell was the pack-in game with that? It was like
Keith Courage.
Oh, that's right.
It was based on some anime.
It's a terrible game, but the graphics are cool. It had lots of colors. And I think my brother's friend's whole reason for getting my brother to buy one was that he wanted someone to trade games with, because no one else had a TurboGrafx-16. So my brother started selling our NES stuff and great games, Super Mario Brothers 2 and all this stuff. And I actually, after my brother got a TurboGrafx-16, I sold my copy of, I traded my copy of Super Mario Brothers 3 for China Warrior. And I always say that was like the worst thing that ever happened.
That is a really bad trade.
Yeah. I remember
when I was a kid, I traded an original Commando Snake Eyes figure for something that wasn't anywhere nearly that good, maybe like Major Blood or something.
Yeah.
And that still burns in my soul, but that's not like trading Super Mario Brothers 3 for China Warrior.
Yeah, at least Major Blood's pretty cool.
He's got like a rocket gun, and he has to wear armor on his arm, and he can't bend it. He doesn't have swivel arm action grip.
Does your Major Blood figure have the dog tags?
Dog tags, yes.
Because that is a dope touch.
Yes.
Like Major Blood has murdered.
You guys should start a G.I. Joe podcast.
I don't know about that.
I can say that there are some great games on the TurboGrafx-16.
Absolutely. So the history behind the TurboGrafx-16, we've talked about it before, but it's important to note that it was called the PC Engine in Japan, and it was actually pretty big over there. It did pretty well for itself. And you have to kind of understand the context in which it launched in Japan, because it debuted in Japan in 1987, which is 2 years before 1989. Yes, that's easy math to do, but the makeup of the market at the time was very different. Like Nintendo's Famicom was actually kind of losing steam, the equivalent of the NES. They launched the disk system to kind of prop it up. Sega hadn't launched the Mega Drive or Genesis over there yet. So it was kind of like this, you know, impressive, new, powerful system, not quite actually 16-bit, but a very, very powerful 16-bit or 8-bit system that had some really good-looking games on it, lots of very, very faithful arcade conversions. It really kind of spanked the NES, and there wasn't anything really to compete with it on that level, and so it did fairly well for itself, but man, 2 years later, it was just coming to America so much, which was such a delay. It just was a completely different market, and it just didn't stand a chance.
The TurboGrafx-16 was not a 16-bit system.
It was not. It had. I have
been lied to for the past.
There was like a
years.
No. Do the math, dude. Like the Jaguar. No, there was like a 16-bit component in the graphics processor. I can't remember the exact details off the top of my head, but it runs on an 8-bit chip. So it is not a proper 16-bit system, but it does have 16-bit components. And so that was the sort of unethical stretch that the NEC Hudson marketing used in the US. And it didn't quite work because there was an actual 16-bit system that debuted like pretty much day and date with the TurboGrafx. Like the Sega Genesis came out here like the same month as the TurboGrafx. And it just like, you know, look at China Warrior versus Altered Beast. They both look really cool, but one of them actually plays okay when the other does not.
Although the Genesis port of Altered Beast isn't that great.
It's not great, but it's better than China Warrior.
That's true.
But yeah, I think like everyone, you know, all the school kids who were willing to jump ship from the juggernaut that the NES was in this country to something with cooler graphics, they all went to the Genesis except for Bench and his one friend. But
yeah.
That sounds like coercion to me, honestly. It was his one friend, and then he was just kind of dragged along in their wake.
It was my brother's friend.
I was really surprised to find out that Benj had one, because I've long had this theory that no one actually owned a TurboGrafx-16.
No, I've known a few people.
Everybody just had one friend who owned it. Like, I had a friend.
No, that was the Master System.
I had a friend in school when I was a child, because this would have been like, when I was 7 or 8, and he had a TurboGrafx-16 and would always tell me about Splatterhouse. Mm-hmm. And I remember
wasn't that the prequel to Splatoon?
Yeah, it's Splatoon House. Secret ending.
Okay, amazing.
And I remember being fascinated by it because I had seen ads in comics, and I'd seen ads in comics for Bonk too. Like Bonk had this 2-page like comic strip style ad that made it look really good. But I remember hearing about Splatterhouse and being like, wait, there's no blood in video games because all I had played was NES games.
Not just blood, but viscera too.
Yeah.
They had an edge. Like there's a great pinball game called Alien Crush, which is one of our favorites, me and my brother's favorites. And it had, gory, crazy alien kind of stuff going on. It wasn't exactly bloody, but it was freaky, like, the alien movies. And I could run off a list of some of the cooler games that we had real quick while we're talking about
it. Go for it. I mean, we're really just talking about 1989 here.
Well, I just...
The launch. Okay, so name of past, and then we can talk about
Because we may never talk about this again.
That's not true. That's not true. The PC Engine was a great system. The TurboGrafx was horribly mismanaged and mistimed in America, but the fundamental system was very, very good.
Yeah, I mean, there's tons of amazing stuff in Japan out on PC Engine.
And even, there are great American games, like Alien Crush, Blazing Lasers, Double Dungeons is really cool. It's a co-op first-person dungeon crawler game, which is like something you never see anywhere, and not even in that time. And Bonk's Adventure is great. I always wanted that, but I didn't get it till way later. And Final Lap Twin is one of the coolest games around because it has an adventure RPG mode where you can wander around and battle guys by racing them and power up your car like an RPG. Cool. And there are other great games. Yeah. But yeah, TurboGrafx-16, I think it's very underrated in general.
At least half of those games were actually 89, so we're still on topic.
Yeah, cool.
Yep, yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bonk's Adventure is kind of weird to me because it's a fun, cute game, but it's so very Japanese in style. Like, it has just, like, a really, really deep visual roots in manga and anime. Mm-hmm. Whereas, they tried to put that up against Super Mario Brothers, but Super Mario Brothers has a much less Japan-specific look to it. Like, there are definitely Japanese elements to Mario, but, like, on the whole, he's a guy from Brooklyn or whatever who punches dragons in the Mushroom Kingdom, so it's not really tied to as much of a place, whereas Bonk is, like, this very super deformed, kind of cartoony guy, and, like, you bonk his head into a dinosaur, and the dinosaur cries big anime-style tears. The America just wasn't ready for that yet.
Do you think that Bonk's Adventure would have done better in America if it had had a pun name like the Japanese version did?
PC Genjin.
PC Genjin.
Sure. What would that pun name be?
I don't know. Turbo.
Turbonk.
Turbonk.
Turbonk's Adventure. I don't know.
This what year was Bonk?
I swear it was after the launch.
I think it was just late 89.
They could have positioned it as a side story to Blazing Lasers and called it Blazing Lasco.
If they had...
The idea would be to go and create cave paintings.
If they had launched the TurboGrafx-16 with Bonk's Adventure instead of Keith Courage, it probably would have done a lot better in America. Because Keith Courage is such a terrible, terrible game.
Yeah, I don't know that I've ever heard of Keith Courage, but
it was the pack-in.
There was a big marketing push for Bonk. I know that. Because there were like TV commercials too, right?
Yeah, and Bonk was a very successful series. And, eventually... Once the TurboGrafx went away and the PC Engine died off, Hudson, the creator of the series, started making NES and Super NES and Game Boy versions. I don't think there was anything on Genesis, but all of them had puns like, PC Genjin means PC Caveman in Japanese, and the system was called PC Engine. So they just kind of kept rolling with that. And so when it went to Nintendo's Famicom, it was FC Genjin. I can't remember. There's a whole bunch. And then there's like Air Zonk, which is like Denjin, which is like Electric Man, and it's set in the future. So like it's a very cleverly named series if you speak Japanese, which kids buying TurboGrafx in the day didn't. So they had to go with Air Zonk, which, fair enough. But there's also the problem that Bonk in Britain is slang for having sex. So that gives it a whole different subtext.
Probably a lot of very disappointed British gamers.
Right? Then. Like, I don't want to have sex with this chap. Anyway.
Blimey.
So kind of the sad, along with the Atari Lynx, like the really cool system that came to America in 1989 and promptly failed to do much of anything. And wait, it's a
one
shame.
More thing. It had a CD attachment.
It did. But that came later.
Well, they advertised it from launch, even though that it was coming.
Yeah, because it debuted in Japan, I want to say in 90, and then launched here, I think, in 92. So it was maybe 91.
It was probably earlier than that, like 90. Okay. In America, because it was out and I wanted one really bad because it was going to be my first CD player.
Oh, actually, yeah, you're right. It debuted in the US in 90 and in Japan in 89.
Yeah, there you go.
And that was a neat company. We had a whole episode about that, about how you weren't on it, but talking about the history of CD-ROM games, Fighting Street, aka Street Fighter, was one of the, if not the very first PC engine, like CD-ROM games specifically designed for CD.
Yeah, I wanted that so bad.
Yeah, it was very expensive, but you missed out on East 1 and 2. Yeah, everyone loves that.
I wanted that too. Didn't get it.
Yeah, so we'll talk about PC Engine more various times, but unfortunately the TurboGrafx itself failed to really account for much of anything. On the other hand, the other big Nintendo competitor to really take the center stage in 1989 kicked lots of butt. Not right away, but it did okay. And that was Sega's Genesis, which was their follow-up to the Master System, which was like a thing that existed. And like the TurboGrafx, there was one kid that you knew who had it. And so I think everyone got like side exposure to the Master System, but not to the point where you could actually get an infection from it. It was just like it was an inoculation, vaccine, basically. Yeah. So it didn't do so well for itself. But the Genesis, Sega just got everything right. They had amazing marketing, a fantastic lineup of games, excellent tech under the hood. They just like they hit on every mark. And by the end of the generation, they had basically gone from owning about 6 or 7% of the console market to pretty much having parity with Nintendo and the Super NES. So that's very impressive.
Did we talk about, I feel like we talked about the Genesis advertising campaign last time.
Did we?
Where, if you go, like, specifically in comic books.
I mean, that's entirely possible, because I talk about that all the time. It's, like, my main topic of conversation in life.
It's bananas. I did that article on Polygon, where I went back through all of Amazing Spider-Man and pulled out the video game ads to talk about them. And you hit 1989, and it's, like, before that had been the big, like, here's a real challenge from Parker Brothers, or whatever. And then 1989, all of a sudden, it's like this screaming face, and it's like, the Genesis will ruin your mind!
Yeah.
And it gets very, it's like, oh, the 90s are about to get here.
Yep.
The walls are splattered with your blood as you play Sega Genesis and your body explodes!
You don't play Sega Genesis, you suck! Like, that's, I don't know how they got that sound into the print ads, but they did.
They did. That was the advent of the Sega Scream. But even putting aside the marketing, like, they made a great case for buying a Sega Genesis straight out of the gate. Let's look at the games, the launch lineup. We're going in a really random order here, but okay. Herzog Zwei, which was produced by Technosoft. Yes. Technosoft, the same people who would go on to make the Thunder Force games for Genesis, which are excellent. And if you haven't picked up the Sega Ages Thunder Force 4, you ought to. But it was kind of a high... Herzog Zwei, did you guys ever play that one?
Kind
of. Benj, I feel like that would be kind of down your alley. Yeah.
I only played it later, since I didn't have a Genesis till 96 or something like that. And I didn't play Herzog Zwei until I probably had to research the history of RTS games for an article or something.
Yeah, because it was a really early RTS engine.
Yeah. So I remember it. I think this is like... You shouldn't have me talking about this, because it's going to be really nebulous and poorly formed, but I remember sort of two ships.
At least you're comfortable
around
with your strengths.
Yeah, I mean, there's like, I was reading the Retronauts reviews, and it said, Benj always comes unprepared, contributes very little. And I'm like, yeah, of course, that's right. That's what I do.
That's what he gets paid for.
Yeah. So it's neat. It's a cool pioneering game. That's about all I can say.
Yeah, I feel like it took the basic concept that Will Wright sort of came up with for Raid on Bungling Bay and did a lot more with it. So it's like a shooter, like a shoot 'em up, a top-down shooter, but instead of being like a forced scrolling game, you have free scrolling throughout the world.
Yeah, like left, right. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, so and so you are like trying to claim territory and basically sort of cultivate emplacements and industry and manufacturing so that you can, you know, fight off against an enemy army. And so, yeah, it's very much a proto RTS that sort of takes place with, you know, instead of having just like a cursor to move around, you control a fighter ship pretty much.
Yeah,
so you're kind of an active participant.
I haven't got a chance to play it, but just looking at it, it really seems like it's definitely on this through line between just top-down shooters and actual RTS games. We're sort of evolving in that direction.
I feel like
go ahead.
It was ahead of its time in terms of the market for consoles wasn't ready for that kind of complexity in
America.
Even
PCs didn't do anything like that. Like Dune 2, Herzogsweih is actually German for Duke 2, but Dune 2 by Westwood Studios came like 1992, I want to say, and that was kind of where the RTS really took form.
Yeah.
But before Dune 2, there was Duke 2, and Technosoft was really leading the way, and I can't remember if that was published by Sega in the US or Renovation or who, but in any case, it's definitely gone down as one of the sort of notable titles on the system that maybe wasn't fully appreciated at the time, but was pretty significant. And I imagine we're going to see a Sega Ages release of that because Sega did buy the entire Technosoft library, I believe. And that's why they published Thunder Force 4 as a Sega Ages title. So I bet they're going to revisit that because I feel like it is a game kind of like Gain Ground that is just like, wow, they were doing this in the 80s, like way ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's completely overlooked. Something amazing.
I wouldn't say completely, but largely. I would say it's not that well
known. I actually had heard of it back then and stuff. I think EGM talked about it and, you know, being cool. But
Sushi SX doesn't really seem like a Herzogsweih fan, but what do I know?
And it's name dropped in a Del the Funky Homo Sapiens song. So, hey.
There you go. That's a claim to fame. Also, in 1989, Phantasy Star 2. I feel like, we haven't had a Phantasy Star episode yet, but we will. One of these days. Anyway, a pretty significant RPG, very ahead of its time, very like doing stuff that Final Fantasy would do a few years later before Final Fantasy did it.
Yeah, I feel like this is one of the games that at that point in my life I would have been really into if I had had a Genesis, which I didn't.
Right.
So I hadn't actually played it. But yeah, I think it would have been my jam.
Unfortunately, Genesis, I would say the platform did not really live up to Phantasy Star 2 in terms of being a great place for playing RPGs. So you had the Phantasy Star games and a handful of other RPGs, but that wasn't really the core strength of the system. The core strength of the system was more like action games and sports games. And that's because Sega put an X68000 chip inside of it, which is, you know, the same thing they were using in their arcade boards. We talked about this in the Sega arcade episodes, but it was basically like, here's the junior version of the games you're playing in the arcades. And some conversions acquitted themselves better than others. I think Super Thunder Blade was one of the early Genesis titles.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of Sega arcade hits, we got Moonwalker on here.
Right.
Which was, that was one of the things that I actually knew about because I'd seen that in arcades, and that I was kind of jealous of the Genesis people getting to play at home, right? Because it just looked so cool in the arcades.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty much your typical brawler, except then you had Michael Jackson in it. So it's not being typical that way. Aleste 2, which is a shooter by Compile and is part of the whole Aleste family, which is, how would you describe the Aleste games? They're top-down shooters and they're dynamic. They have dynamic difficulty. So the better you play, the harder the games become until you get to a point where you are no longer playing that well because it's destroying you.
Yeah, this is one I never really saw a lot of. It's got that, it's still got that sort of, you know, alien derived look to it. You're doing all these, you know, Geiger-esque backdrops and stuff, but I don't know a lot about the gameplay on it.
I've never been a fan of vertical space shooters that much, other than like Blazing Lasers.
They're really good on the Nintendo Switch when played with a flip grip. I'll just
that's true. There. I need one of those.
Can I tell my very good joke about Aleste? Aleste 2, of course, is also known as Bileste. And then, of course, 30 years later in 2018 would lead to Celeste, which was a really good game.
Have you been workshopping that over there?
Just like for the past 20 minutes, I've just been thinking about it.
Yeah. Guys, I've got a good one. Just hang on.
I just really wanted to talk about Celeste. It's very good. That's all.
So maybe we should segue this through since we're all flailing.
Oh, you forgot to talk about Alex Kidd. What do you mean flailing?
Okay. Alex Kidd's Sega's cool mascot character? He's got so much attitude.
Yeah. He's got 2Ds. I hate 2Ds. All the Alex Kidd games.
Full disclosure, Jeremy is currently drinking from a Sonic the Hedgehog mug, and I wish it was an Alex Kidd mug.
Yeah, it should be.
Everything you pour in there turns into poison. It's like the false grail. I would immediately turn old and wither into dust.
Poorly.
But yeah, Alex Kidd was another thing that was just really not playing to the strengths because, you know, they were going for their whole loud vibe here. And then we've got this thing that's really just sort of pulled back and in some ways more directly comparable to Mario, but it just kind of looks like a duller Mario.
It's a strange game. I've never been able to really get into the
Alex Kidd and games. The mechanics are weird, and the whole look is kind of toy box kind of
deal.
They're
all terrible. Alex Kidd games are terrible games.
They really put the system to work on that color popping technology and forgot to make a good game.
I feel like they're all like they were great in 1983 kind of games. Like that would have been groundbreaking back then. And they're great on the Master System, but not really. You know, but then after Super Mario Brothers came along, you can't just release things like Alex Kidd that's like all like jerky and, you know, like, and you know what I mean? Like the controls aren't great. Yeah. I don't know if there's momentum in that game or anything. And don't you die easily? Like if you just tap something?
Yes.
Like, I don't know.
Alex Kidd is extremely fragile.
Yeah. So I feel like they just aren't very good, honestly.
I feel like there's someone out there who could make offer a passionate defense of the Alex Kidd games.
Yeah, I mean, like the weird combo of mechanics it has going on, you know, I could see someone being into that, but yeah, I don't know.
I don't know why they kept making them. Somebody in Japan loved the punishing difficulty of them maybe or something, and they just kept making them.
I don't know, but once Sonic came along, that was the last you saw of Alex Kidd.
Yeah.
They said, well, you know what? People actually like this game because it's fun and interesting and appealing. And Alex Kidd is not. Oh, Chris, you and your sour face. Hey, did you guys hear that I dropped a really cool 1989 reference in there when I talked about the False Grail? You know what came out that year? Yeah. That's right. It was Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade.
I appreciate it.
There were actually a bunch of really kind of significant pop culture movies released that year. I feel like, yes?
Oh, I'm just waiting. I'm waiting.
Yeah, I just feel like... Not even movies, but I just feel like there was the media that year had a very, like was very closely tied to the same sort of youth age people. What am I trying to say here?
Youth culture. Like
it was, the cultural zeitgeist.
I didn't want to say youth culture because it killed my dog. And I don't think that's fair.
There's a very funny bit if you watch the Weird Al movie UHF. If you watch it with commentary on, where they talk about why, you know, a lot of reasons why UHF was maybe a huge failure at the box office, but the main one was that it came out the same week as Last Crusade and Batman.
Yeah. That was.
Yeah.
I did see it in the theaters.
Yeah.
It's a good movie.
It is. I think it's held up pretty well for the
except
most part.
Except for Victoria Jackson, but.
Yeah, it's good. What about, didn't Ghostbusters 2 come out in 89?
Maybe, but I try not to think about that one.
But it was exciting at the time.
Yeah, until I saw it, and then I was like, okay. But Buzz yeah,
got
like
Bobby Brown in 80, it.
Yeah. Is he actually in the movie, or is it just
he has
music?
A little cameo thing.
Does he? Okay.
Like, my kid wants one of those.
Man, how do I get a Pokemon? That guy is too hot to handle.
Yeah. I don't know if I have ever seen in my life a bigger and more prominent marketing campaign than Batman 89's. Like, Yeah, and I have lived through multiple Star Wars movies.
I mean, do you remember the Last Jedi or no, the Force Awakens? Because that was
it,
everywhere.
It was big, yeah. But like you, I remember being a kid and just seeing the Batman symbol everywhere. It seemed
bigger to you at the time, but I feel like marketing campaigns have gotten bigger. Oh my God, the Phantom Menace was like,
yeah,
you could buy Star Wars potatoes and stuff. Like,
but Batman was. They really put everything behind it, you know, like everything that you could put behind it.
They did. That logo was
on everything.
Yeah. I would say Batman was the first big sort of modern media campaign for a movie, to promote a movie, like to turn it into an event.
Yes.
Because up until, you know, I had Star Wars and stuff like that. And then there were lots of sort of notable movies that happened throughout the latter 80s. But then Batman arrived and they were just like, we're going all in on this.
Yeah.
And they, yeah, you're right. They put everything into it. It was everywhere on like Happy Meals because it's such a kid-friendly movie.
The cereal that came with the bank.
Yeah. And video games, of course.
Such a kid-friendly movie where Batman just murders countless people.
But, you know, 1989 was the point at which, you know, it was kind of like peak Generation X, like early adolescence. And so I really feel like that is a big part of why we saw that, because, you know, marketing companies and publishers and everyone, they were starting to kind of realize like, hey, there's, you know, the economy is good and kids have money. And if we can get them to convince their parents to buy stuff, their parents will buy stuff and we'll make a lot of money that way. And so, yeah, so you really started to see this move toward a different approach to marketing that had sort of evolved throughout the 80s, but it definitely culminated in 89 with Batman and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade and Ghostbusters 2, I guess. Was that 89?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was.
Okay.
TMNT, I think, is a really interesting case.
And Milli Vanilli. That was 89, I think.
You know, Eastman and Laird create TMNT at their kitchen table in 84. And it's a joke because they're doing what's the most popular thing in comics so that we can make a lot of money? Well, there's X-Men and there's Daredevil, which are comics about teenage mutants and ninjas. So they do this thing as a joke and then they kind of make it a serious comic. That's really dark. I mean, like Shredder, you know, commits suicide with a hand grenade at the end of the first arc of Ninja Turtles. And then 87, it becomes the animated series. And at that point, it becomes, I always define it as, you know, you can mark out these eras in pop culture, or at least for, you know, people around my age, the way we perceive things. And it's like Ninja Turtles is this inescapable pop cultural franchise. It's the most popular thing in the world until 1993 when Power Rangers comes out. And then Power Rangers is ubiquitous until 1998 when Pokemon comes out. And then that's, you know, that's the ages for me, ages 5 to 20.
Yeah, actually, you're interesting about 87 era there. I know this is not 89, but that's sort of when the whole first wave of like He-Man and G.I. Joe sort of petered out too.
Yeah. Right?
Like Transformers too.
Transformers, like mm-hmm. that early 80s stuff.
And then
it's interesting.
It all kind of gets consolidated in Ninja Turtles.
Well, and video games too.
Yeah, and video games.
Yeah, I mean, I very much transitioned from like collecting Transformers to collecting Nintendo. This is, you know, speaking of kids with money, this is when I was putting my own, because my parents, when I was growing up, were very skeptical of this whole video game thing. So, you know, they didn't buy stuff for me, but they were going to let me spend my own money. So, you know, I saved up and bought myself an NES very shortly before this, which is a lot of the reason that all that Genesis marketing kind of bounced off me, because I was invested over here now.
Yeah.
But
I have a whole thing about how Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is the most important comic book in history after Action Comics number one and Fantastic Four number one. But we will get into that another time.
Mm.
On the half shell, they're the heroes for. In this day and age, who could ask for more? The crime wave is high, with muggings mysterious. All police and detectives are furious, cause they can't find the source of this lethally evil force. This is serious, so give me a quarter. I was a witness, get me a reporter. Call April O'Neill.
So, yeah, we should actually talk about the video game part of this, because it is all sort of inextricably tied together, especially the TMNT part. But first, we should talk about just the fact that Nintendo was on top of the world. Like, this was peak Nintendo up until, like, the Wii DS era. And even then, like, even though those were, you know, top-selling systems of all time, They didn't have nearly so much of the market share as they commanded at the pinnacle of the NES era. 1989 you know,
they had like 90-something% market share in the US or something.
Yeah. And everyone, you know, I said that earlier, the Famicom had flagged out around this time, but the NES was just starting to really catch on and become like the indomitable force that it really was. And you look at the lineup this year, and it's fantastic. And Nintendo was doing so well that they didn't just have one system, they had two, because in 1989, they also launched the Game Boy. And that came with kind of all the crowd pleasers that kids loved on NES. You had, you know, in the first few months of the system's life, you had not only Tetris, which was a big deal, but you also had Super Mario Land. You had a Castlevania game. A Final Fantasy game came shortly after that was a tie-in to the big push that they were making with Final Fantasy over on NES. There was a Bugs Bunny game. There was all kinds of stuff. Nintendo just kind of basically said, let's leverage our strengths that we have on consoles and turn those into a handheld market. And it was also a monster. In fact, the Game Boy remains one of the absolute like top two or three best-selling game systems of all time. It was that big.
I believe it.
And I mean, part of that's because it was around forever.
Yeah.
It was, but also because it was just there. Tetris. Yeah, it was just like a thing that everyone bought their kids because you were like, well, these kids were taking a long car trip and they're going to be loud. So let's shut them up with a Game Boy, which, you know, get them a couple of games. It's cheap. You get batteries run on that thing forever. So that's our pacifier.
Yeah, we talked about this when we were talking about some of the other portable systems that came out afterwards, and they were, you know, so much more powerful. But one of the huge things was the Game Boy would still outlast any of them for ages, if you just needed something to keep going.
Tetris, I mean, the original Tetris on the Game Boy is still fun and still playable today. I mean, it's just as great as it ever was, even with the murky screen. And there's something cool about the Game Boy that a lot of people forget is that it came with earbuds, which is like one of the first pop culture.
It was a stereo system.
Earbud releases, so.
The little red and blue.
Yeah, the red blue ones. It's really cool.
So let's talk about some games that came out on NES in 1989. Here's a list: Mega Man 2, Ninja Gaiden, Tetris, A Boy and His Blob, Dragon Warrior, Power Glove, Adventures of Lolo, Dragon Quest, Double Dragon 2, the DuckTales, the River City Ransom, Mindell Palace. Who put that there? The Zelda Game & Watch, that's not even a Nintendo's NES game, and Willow, which...
Mindell Palace is good.
I like Willow.
Mindell Palace is good, but it's not exactly like, you know, massive mindshare.
It's not a hit, but I feel like if people don't know about Mindell Palace and you go back and play Mindell Palace, you'll be very pleasantly surprised.
That was an early Game Freak game, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. So it's the origins of Pokemon.
Yeah, it's one of those...
Actually, was that their first game?
I believe it was. It was...
Quinty in Japan.
Quinty, what's his name? Satoshi.
Tobiyashi Maru.
No.
Game Freak guy.
Satoshi Taijiri.
Yes.
Yeah.
I believe it was not his first game, but like his first major game, because he had won that contest when he was a kid. And it's really interesting to think about, I've seen interviews with him. I think it was the big special Game Center CX episode where he talks about his game design philosophy being based around verbs. And so Pokemon is based around trade and catch.
And fight.
And
kill.
Faint. And Mindell Palace is based around the verb flip. So what can you do with flipping things? And it's a really clever puzzle game. And I am genuinely shocked that we've never gotten Super Mindell Palace or like Mindell Palace DX. You know, it seems like a very simple and obvious thing that after the success of Game Freak, they would have re-released.
You know, they don't, aside from Pokemon, they don't tend to revisit their ideas much. They come up with a new idea and then they move on to the next thing. Like, they have a game, Giga Wrecker, that's coming out. It's been out on Steam for a couple of years, but it's finally coming to consoles. And it's not like anything else they've done. And if you look at Drill Dozer, which we just recently had an episode about, it's not like anything else they've done. If you look at Pulse Man, that's not really anything else like anything else they did. So yeah, that was that's just kind of Game Freak's approach, like one and done, and then Pokemon to keep the lights on for everyone, basically, for Niantic and Nintendo and the Pokemon Company. Yeah. And
they're very good games. But yeah, go back, like if you are an NES fan, if you're a puzzle game fan, go back to Mindell Palace if you haven't played it, and I think you will find it to be highly enjoyable.
Yeah, Bob. I know Bob is a big fan. One of the first things he wrote for a publication that I ran was a piece on Mendel Palace. So he could probably speak better to that. If we do an episode, we'll have to have him talk.
Mendel Palace is a terrible name for that game, though.
Yeah,
there's a lot of video game names that tell you nothing about the game. And I think Mendel Palace is one of those.
Mm. We could call it Quinty, but that doesn't really tell you that.
Quinty also doesn't.
It should be called Flip something.
Flippy.
Flippers.
Flip Palace.
Flip Palace, yeah.
Flip Grip.
Flip Grip.
I'm glad they didn't call it Flip Grip.
So I don't know where to begin with all these NES games.
Yeah.
Let's work our way up.
Yeah, so
Willow. You guys, did you ever play the NES version of Willow?
I had Willow.
I didn't have it, but I played a little bit.
I still started up every once in a while just to listen to the music because it's so cool and haunting and interesting. The music is really good. So it's essentially a top-down action RPG similar to A Link to the Past, but it does actually have RPG elements where you can level up. Yeah. So it's neat and it's underrated and it's incredibly difficult in some places. You have to have a lot of patience with it and get the skill down of how to swipe the guys with your sword and all that stuff. But I think it's a great game. I think it's really underrated and it's just a little too difficult sometimes. I remember playing it through the whole thing while cheating as a kid, just so I could experience it because of all the neat music and it's very atmospheric. It has a really dark palette, but
I would say an earthy palette.
Yeah. Earthy palette. Mm-hmm, you know, the limited color palette available on the NES, but it made good use of that. And I always felt like it didn't really have to tie in with the movie at all, even though it does to some extent.
It's nothing at all like Capcom's arcade version, which is like an action, it's a side-scrolling platformer with RPG elements. But this is this is more Zelda Crystallis style, and it has a really interesting mechanic that you still don't see very often, where there's like level gating on the things you acquire. So you can get better weapons, but you can't actually use them until you hit a certain level. And so you have to, you can't just like go get the best sword and then, you know, immediately kill stuff. You have to level up to that point.
Yeah, it has a little LV or whatever.
Yeah, it's very Crystallis.
It's great. It's a neat game. Everybody should try it out.
I remember reading about this in Nintendo Power, and looking back, I feel like it's endemic of one of the really interesting factors of the NES being absolutely dominant at this point in time, which is that if you were going to have a pop culture sensation, it had to have an NES game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is how we get bizarre license games like Platoon, for example. who wanted that one?
Yeah.
But you get all of these weird Nintendo games based on just whatever people were trying to make big at the time.
Yeah, and it's always interesting to see, you know, you farm it to some company to make, and sometimes you get just some licensed garbage, and then sometimes it clicks and you get something really interesting.
That's what's neat about Willow. It's one of those rare things that surpasses the movie in quality. I mean, I like the movie, but
I don't know if it would hold up at all.
It feels like it was developed by a Japanese company to me.
It was Capcom.
Okay, so I don't remember who it was, but man.
If you farmed your licensed game out to Capcom, odds were pretty good.
Yeah.
See, also DuckTales.
Yeah, so.
Which was done by, we talked about this in the episode, but like the Mega Man 2 crew, basically. And it feels like it. It looks like fantastic. It sounds like it.
It's amazing that company put out Mega Man 2 and DuckTales in the same year.
Yeah, I feel like we don't even need to talk about Mega Man 2, but if you guys want to, go ahead.
It's quite good.
I mean, it was one of the first things I bought.
The music
after.
Stood out for me. Music resonates with me, I guess, because I'm a musician. But before I was a musician, I loved the music of Mega Man 2. Isn't Snake Man in that? Or is that?
No, that's Mega Man 3.
Okay. That's 3.
I don't remember the best stage in Mega Man 2, but it has great music.
It's Wily Stage 1.
Okay.
But yeah, it was also, it was one of the really early things, because I came into the NES with Super Mario Brothers 2, which was just 88, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I had been jealous about all the other schoolyard kids having their NES for a while and then came in. And then we hit here 89 with all these great things coming out. And Mega Man 2 was fantastic. And also ended up becoming like my first experience with franchise fatigue. Because I was like, this is great. And I bought Mega Man 3 and it was great. And I bought Mega Man 4 and it was,
keep going.
Yeah. But for the early bits here.
I do feel like there's a pretty big drop in quality, especially once you get to 5 and 6. Like 2 and 3.
6 is underrated.
2 and 3 are like stellar. And 4, I think, is fun. But 5 and 6, those came out like, I think X was either out or in development then, and I feel like that's where they were paying attention. Because X
six,
is great.
6 and X are pretty much concurrent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't think even Capcom had much faith in it because Nintendo released it over here. Anyway, we've done Mega Man episodes. Yeah. We've also done a Ninja Gaiden episode, but it's been a while. We could talk about Ninja Gaiden, the game that played Birds. Just like the movie.
Wow. Yeah.
What's the third level of that game like? I've
never seen it. Me neither. But the music is great in that one, too.
See, the third stage is that's not the... Oh, that's the one where you start to see the birds. The eagles really start coming after you in stage 3.
So the one with the cliffs?
Yeah, you're in the cliffs and everything.
Was that stage 3? But I have seen stage 3.
Yeah.
But nothing past it. Nope. Yeah.
Have you seen the castle cutscene where you stand and you look out in the horizon and there's a castle?
I don't.
Because that's...
I've seen...
I know I got to the birds.
This one. I'm making a little rectangle around right, my eyes. Right. I've seen that one a lot.
Yeah, just a girl. Get out of here. I actually just did a live stream of this and played it, you know, for the first time in ages. And I was really surprised by how effectively my muscle memory from when I was a kid served me. Because I was like, yeah, I'm probably not going to make it past this stage. And then I would make it past that stage and be like, wow, okay.
Better.
I got all the way to the... I got all the way to the very end of the game. But at that point, I was just like... I'm so tired. I'm so old and so tired. I don't have the wherewithal to do this for people's entertainment. So I had to call it a day. But yeah, it's really a game about learning patterns and rhythms. And once you get a sense of once you memorize, there's going to be a thing come at me right here and I need to scroll past it, or I just need to ignore it and jump past it, or I need to pick up this weapon and then activate it a certain time. It's a little prescribed, I think, but once you kind of get into the rhythm of the game and you're willing to kind of approach it on its own terms, it's very fast, very fluid. The controls are extremely responsive. It is well designed despite being hateful and punishing.
It's like a fair, hard game to me. Because it's very difficult, but it didn't make me frustrated.
There's a lot of older NES games where they're really hard, and it's because they control like crap. Yeah. And you're like, I want to do things, but somehow the game is not interpreting the buttons that I press to make it do that.
But there's
Whereas Ninja Gaiden, if you know what to do, and you can press the buttons in the right combos, it's going to do exactly what you tell it to. So when you screw up, it's because you screwed up.
Yeah, and there's a lot of, I think we've talked about this before in other contexts, but there was a lot of this game design philosophy in this era of it was okay for games to be hard in a way where you just had to learn the game. And because, again, I think this was an era when only a lot of us were kids saving up our money and buying one game and then spending a lot of time with it. And so, an arcade style game, it's not actually that long. And so the way you spend a lot of time with it is for it to be really difficult, but difficult in a way that you can get better at it. And so there was a lot of this design where you just, you have to learn the enemy placements. You have to learn where the weapons are and you slowly get better and get farther in it. And I feel like that doesn't fly as much today in the area where people can save state, or where you just expect to be able to pick up things on the fly and not have to really grind to learn it. And I don't know how I don't think I could do the grind to learn game so much today. I don't have the time and the patience to sit with one game playing through the same level 50 times over until I master it. But back in this context, that was okay. I picked up this one game and I learned it,
like a holdover from the punishing elements of arcade games where they just wanted to kill you for quarters, and then it adapted more to the NES where you could memorize the stages and get through them, and there was very little media competition back then. Like you're saying, you had one game and you played it for months.
Yeah, were four channels on TV.
Yeah, so
and one of them was PBS. Come on.
But
that's not exciting for a kid. It's great. I'm glad it exists. But
speak for yourself.
Okay. Yeah. Aside from Sesame Street.
Nova
3-2-1.
Oh, yeah.
3-2-1 Contact.
3-2-1 Contact was awesome. Anyways.
I just want to say about Ninja Gaiden, wasn't it the second stage that had the rain pushing you around?
No, that's Ninja Gaiden 2.
Ninja Gaiden 2? Okay. Mm-hmm. Darn. Well, that was my favorite.
Getting it all conflated in your brain.
Yeah, sorry.
I was really hoping beating the messenger would make me retroactively better at Ninja Gaiden, and then I went back to Ninja Gaiden, and it did not.
I feel like Celeste would make you retroactively better at Ninja Gaiden.
Celeste makes you better at every video game.
Right, so there you go. That's very much in the same philosophy, but kind of modernized. And so you don't have things like lose at the final boss and you get sent back 3 stages. That's it. DJ's the man we love the most. Yeah, actually, that was the last thing I wanted to talk about from 1989, because I feel like it's the first significant and innovative Western-designed game to come out for a console following the Atari crash.
Yeah, it feels like a PC game in a lot of ways.
Do you think that's a fair
characterization? Yeah, I never thought of it that way. But yeah, since it's a David Crane game, the Pitfall guy, you know, mm-hmm. Activision alum.
It's very much like the next step on from Pitfall 2, but this time the core of the game is not just like run around and find treasure, but it's actually, you know, solve puzzles with the tools you have at hand.
Fascinating. Yeah. I mean, me and my brother had a blast at this game because we had to, I think you have to figure out what color bean does what at first. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't,
I think the manual tells you, doesn't it?
Maybe we didn't have the manual because we rented it.
I think maybe
it tells you for some of them, but not all of them.
Yeah, if you like, maybe you have to, it's been a while since I've played it, but I think if you like use a jelly bean, maybe this is just the Game Boy sequel, but it'll like, once you figure out its effect, then it'll say it when you bring it up.
Stuff, yeah. After it may do that.
Icarus Ladder, Ripier Rocket, Honey Hummingbird, Coconut.
It's really cool how there are all these jelly beans that do different things when you feed them to your blob, and then your blob turns into a tool or some kind of object that helps you get past a puzzle and progress in the game. And it was delightful in terms of being a sort of depthy NES puzzle game when there weren't a lot of those. It wasn't all action oriented. You actually had to think, and it reminded me of a PC game at the time.
It was by someone who kind of grew up with developed his game design chops on Atari and then switched over to C64. So I feel like that mentality really kind of carried over into Crane's console work, and it wasn't always successful, but I feel like in this case it is a really interesting game. It has some flaws, but I think it holds up pretty well, and it's interesting to explore, and it is very much a game about exploration.
Yeah, and it almost feels like there's some, and this may be the wrong term because it's such a loaded term these days, but like some kind of open world elements to it, in that you can do things like, you know, jump off something and glide through several screens and end up in a different part of the game, which is the sort of thing you would expect in a PC game, but was very unexpected on NES.
Yeah, like, it's a game.
Other games didn't work that way.
It's a game that rewards experimentation and sort of like figure it out on your own. And it can be really ruthless and cruel. Like, it's very possible to be doing very well and then get to an unfamiliar area and experiment, and wow, you're out of lives, game over, start from the beginning.
I think you can also use multiple solutions to the same problem, I think, if you're creative, which is something like an emergent property. It reminds me of Scribblenauts later, where you could do different solutions to, you know, problem, something like
right.
that.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I really like Boy and His Blob, although it has a lot of problems. And there wasn't a good follow-up to it until until WayForward took the license and turned it into more of a concrete puzzle game.
Wasn't there a Wii?
Yeah, that was Wii 2009 one? Yeah. by WayForward, which is really kind of a different game in a lot of respects, but it did a good job of distilling the concept into something that was a little more friendly to contemporary audiences. And also there was a hug
button. Yeah, you can't feel bad about that.
You hug the blob, and that's it. That's the only thing that button does. I love it.
Yeah.
All right, so we need to...
Wait, River City Ransom. Did you ever talk about that on the podcast?
We have talked about that on the podcast for sure.
I love it.
It is an action RPG.
Yes.
Actually, we need to do a Kunio-kun episode at some point.
Yeah.
Or just like all of that. Renegade, River City Ransom, those crazy sports games are all part of the same family.
Yep.
And there are some people who are very, very obsessive and kind of annoying about it, but they are good games, and you should not let that hold that against them. All right, so let's wrap up 1989 by just kind of mentioning some of the important games that appeared on PCs. Most of these would appear later on consoles because there started to be less of a kind of obvious division between consoles and computers at this point. I mean, there definitely was a division, but there was a lot more crossover starting in the early 90s. So you have... Why, there's Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. You know what? We should do an entire episode about that movie and the games. Okay, great. So let's see. Over in Japan, Dragon Slayer, The Legend of Heroes, which is a series that is still ongoing. Third Trails in the Sky, or I think Trails of Cold Steel. I can't remember. I can't keep track of all these spinoffs, but that was just announced for the US. It's coming out on PS4 this fall.
Wait, I didn't even know that was connected to Dragon Slayer.
Yeah, it's Dragon Slayer, Legend of Heroes, Trails in the Sky. It's,
okay.
It's got a lot of subtitles. There's a lot of branches, a lot of layers.
Yeah, that whole
It has
family.
nothing logistically and in terms of mechanics to do with Dragon Slayer. It was just, we went through this in the Dragon Slayer episode, but basically it was like, there was a guy, I can't remember his name, Kia something. Damn it. Anyway, he created a bunch of RPGs that had some like loose spiritual similarities, but that's really the only connections there. And it became kind of a running franchise for him. Let's see. Shadow of the Beast. You guys dare play this? It's not very good.
I don't like it.
But it is beautiful. This is the kind of game that computer shops would just put on their Amiga at the front of the shop and just let that run the attract mode. And you would stop and you would be like, I need to own this computer because it is extraordinary. This just this amazing animation.
Oh, this is the prog rock album cover.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's
beat 'em up. Right.
Right. It's developed by Psygnosis, and Roger Dean did some of the artwork and the logo.
Okay. So yeah, I've seen it exactly like you say, you know, in a shop window.
And it's not a fun game. It's not a fair game, but it's beautiful. It's like, yeah, like I always kind of conflated it in my head as a kid with Altered Beast, but they're very different games.
I think it's wildly overrated.
It's not a good game, but it looks extraordinary. But
people on Amiga love it. That's like their baby, you know?
You bought that game and you convinced yourself you liked it because nothing else looked like that at the time. It was just a tremendous achievement in graphical design. Just gorgeous. At the other end of the spectrum, you have Minesweeper and Solitaire. Very, very sort of fundamental, ugly even games, but very addictive, very playable, maybe among the most played video games ever.
Yeah, but why? They say 1990 after him. Why is that?
Because there have been, I don't know who put that there.
Me.
But
because they came out with Windows 3.0 in 1990.
Okay.
Yeah, so they aren't 89 games.
What?
Well, they probably...
Yeah.
Were they just distributed differently? I don't know.
No. They just... That's when they came out, 1990. So we jumped the gun on this.
Why didn't you just delete them from the list?
Because I thought I was giving you a chance to remedy it. I put 1990 in the parentheses.
Jeez. See, this is it. Yeah. Okay, there we go.
Moving on.
I think we should do an entire full episode on Microsoft Solitaire.
That would be cool.
And rank all the card backs.
I mean, I've said many times... that those are two of the most important games of all time. But anyway.
How about Prince of Persia? That was the real, like, I saw that in Windows, store Windows.
Yes,
and they were
definitely
advertising the graphics because of the fluid animation and VGA graphics.
I saw that in Babbage's.
Time.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we've talked about that one on the Macintosh episodes.
Yes.
But it has a... okay, so between Prince of Persia and Ninja Gaiden, you basically, and I guess Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, you have video games saying like, hey, I think we can figure out how to do this movie thing. We can be movie-like in different ways. With Prince of Persia, it was the animation and the staging of the stages. Well, that sounds really stupid. Staging of the levels. Ninja Gaiden, it was the cutscenes. And then Indiana Jones was like, here's a story that you're working through and there's different pathways. Wow. Crazy.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
There was a really good, is that what you're talking about? The adventure game?
Yeah.
The Last Crusade. Yeah. That was a good one. And what about SimCity?
SimCity. Yeah.
Yeah. SimCity and Populous. Coins, two sides of the same coin and kind of related to Herzog's Vi. Honestly, SimCity emerged out of Radon Bungling Bay, which was Will Wright's sort of proto RTS that Herzog's Vi, I don't know if it was based on it, but it definitely, it had to have been like somewhat inspired by Radon Bungling Bay because that was a pretty big game on Famicom.
Yeah, I feel like you're right about that.
Yeah. Anyway, we are not making very quick progress here. So why don't we take a break for just a second and then come back and wrap this episode with a brisk journey through 1999.
Doris Day, Red China, Johnny Ray, Sapa, Syndic, Walter Winchell, Joe DiMaggio, Joe McCarthy, Richard Nixon, Studebaker, Television, North Korea, South Korea, Marilyn Monroe. Rosenberg, Sage, Bomb, Sugar Ray, Panmunjom, Randall, the King and I, and the Catcher in the Rye.
Somebody once told me the world is gonna roll me. I ain't the sharpest tool in the shed. She was looking kind of dumb with her finger and her thumb in the shape of an L on her forehead. Well, the years start coming and they don't stop coming. Fed to the rules and I hit the ground running. Didn't make sense not to live for fun. Your brain gets smart, but your head gets dumb. So much to do, so much to see. So what's wrong with taking the back streets? You'll never know.
All right, it's time to move on to 1999, and I've just got one question for you. Do I make you horny, baby? Oh, I'm sorry.
There were better things in 1999.
I know, but we just had to get the terrible thing out of the
way. All right.
Austin Powers 2. Yeah. But you know what also happened that year? The Matrix and Star Wars. Episode 1.
Episode.
I decided to watch The Clone Wars before it gets delisted from Netflix. So I've been doing that while I exercise over the past few weeks. And I thought, you know, before I start doing that, I should go back and revisit The Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones to kind of like set the stage for it. And The Phantom Menace is a really interesting movie. I don't think it's very good, but it kind of falls into the same category as Metal Gear Solid 2, where it's deeply flawed and yet very forward-thinking, like very, very like, I kind of feel like George Lucas, maybe despite himself, was onto something. Like in 1999, 20 years ago, everyone was like, a movie about trade embargoes, who cares? And now we're like, wow, so there's a neoliberal government that's being rotted from within by a petty tyrant with a grudge who is using fascism and war to tear this you know long-standing empire apart, and his primary tool is a guy who's basically like a creep to women and an angry man-child who's not used to never getting his way, who lucked into a position of great power through basically winning the lottery of his birth. Okay. Yeah.
Modern sensibilities.
I'm, it's resonating a little bit.
I will say this.
Definitely things I liked in that movie.
Yeah. The Phantom Menace. I think it's a horrible Star Wars movie, but if it were something else, everyone would love it. I think if it were a different franchise, like a cult, not, you know what I mean? Like, Chris is looking at me like with death eyes.
I feel like I stepped into a parallel universe when I went to go get some more water, and now I have no idea what's going on. It's not good.
You see what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's not good. We're trying to cut it some slack.
Also, that is fundamentally a movie for babies about laser swords, and it's boring.
Yeah, well, if you took away the baby stuff, like the laser swords, that's okay. But the anything to do with Gungans and Jar Jar, like, it's just so tone deaf. Yes.
Yeah, if it was a completely different movie, it'd be great.
No.
Yeah.
It's an interesting movie and there is some good stuff to it. But in any case, it definitely did not hold up to the scrutiny that everyone placed on it because it was so hugely hyped up. It was the first really like take over the world kind of marketing campaign, I would say, since Batman 89. Like a decade building to this, and Lucas was really building. He got divorced and was like, I lost all my money, so I'm going to bring Star Wars back, and we're going to start by remastering the old movies and re-releasing them in theaters, which hadn't happened. You know, you didn't see theatrical re-releases that much anymore at that point. And all of that culminated in The Phantom Menace. And they did a great job of selling it. Those early trailers were so evocative and intriguing. And we were like, we're going to finally find out what's the deal with Darth Vader and the Emperor. And then we saw that he was Jake Lloyd, and I'm sure Jake Lloyd is a great person and was a nice kid, but just he was not directed well. Let's say that nothing in that movie was directed well. It's so static and lifeless.
I consider myself an empathetic person, mildly so. I have never had. I don't know if I've had sympathy for anyone as much as I've had sympathy for Jake Lloyd.
Yeah,
who's jeepers Christmas? That poor kid, poor guy. No, I mean he's like 30.
Yeah.
No, there was good stuff in that movie and the next ones, but they both needed more editing and more directing.
And more rewriting. Princess Leia couldn't save the script.
Yeah.
There's definitely potential in those movies. Anyway, I didn't mean to get off onto a sidetrack because
meanwhile,
that is what this podcast is about.
Is there anywhere else on the internet people can go to hear people talking about all the flaws with Star Wars Episode One. Is there anywhere else? I don't think there is. I've looked.
Okay.
Well, is there anywhere with people? Try
to use a Google.
Oh, okay.
It's very handy.
Is there anywhere with people who actually kind of like the movie?
Yes, actually.
There are.
I've been asking Jeeves, so.
Oh, that's it. Yeah. I would stop using Lycos and Alta Vista. They're not much help anymore. Okay.
Yeah.
That's 99. Actually, did Google start in 99 or was that 98?
98.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we don't have to talk about Google and how it's
become. But, you know, Alta Vista was still around, so.
The evil empire. All
right.
All right.
So meanwhile.
Also, The Matrix, which was kind of one of those movies that came out of nowhere and became the monster hit that satisfied people when Star Wars let them down, pretty much by word of mouth. Like, it was drew heavily on the graphic novel and movie Dark City, and drew heavily on Kung Fu style wire foo. Yes.
Also drew heavily on Wi-Fi.
I'm only three
bars.
It
did. Just think how different things would have been for Neo if he'd had a little Wi-Fi router in the back of his brain. But yeah, like it was very of its time. Like it was very zeitgeisty.
I rewatched The Matrix. My wife and I had like a Keanu Reeves film festival last year.
So you should have invited me.
Oh,
would have been great.
Holds up.
Yeah,
talking about Bram Stoker's Dracula, The Matrix, Point Blank. Point Break. Point Blank is Name Marvel.
No, that's a game series. I think it came out in 99 also.
I feel like The Matrix was the 21st century version of Die Hard, in that it's like every action movie that came after it was trying to be it. Like, it's super, super influential.
Well, you know, interestingly, that's also true of The Phantom Menace. Even though people hated that movie, supposedly, and it was widely decried, that is the movie that gave us the ubiquitous goddamn CG armies facing off against each other, and nothing really matters because it's just like huge things
fighting each other.
Yeah, like, I don't care. I don't care about your battle droids and your Gungans. Yeah. I don't care about your Wakandans fighting whatever the hell Thanos is throwing at them. Like, just show us the characters we care about dealing with each other. The Chitauri? Okay, there we go.
Yes.
It's okay.
Avatar,
anyway, I'm saying like that movie is responsible. It has a lot to answer for.
Yeah.
Because you really saw that kind of take off with Lord of the Rings, but it started with The Phantom Menace, and I hate it so much.
Yeah, I would even see that at like work. I would go to the SIGGRAPH graphics conference, and every year there would be someone demoing a new massive battle simulation like technology for like the next several years after this.
You know what the only good massive battle has been? It's been the Battle of the Bastards and Game of Thrones, because it was all just real people except the giant. It was like they actually got all those people there, and it feels real.
And because it focuses in on important characters doing important things while something's happening around them.
As opposed to like a big battle happening, and then elsewhere there's other characters doing other things, and who cares about that big battle? It's just there. It's just like texture.
Yeah.
I can think of better texture, like Houndstooth or, you know.
It's just
Prince of Wales plaid.
Yeah.
Maybe instead of making pixels fight each other, we could write some movies. That's my thought.
Wouldn't that be great? Anyway, so those are kind of the big pop culture juggernauts, that and Austin Powers 2, that happened in 1999. And they're the backdrop for a lot of video games, but the makeup of the industry was very different than in 1989. You had Sega also launching a system and not becoming a massive juggernaut that challenged everyone, and they deserved to. The Dreamcast was Sega's heart and soul.
It had great things.
They put everything into that system and its software, and it just...
I loved it. I love the Dreamcast.
Me too.
I mean, I admit that I'm not like... the games on Dreamcast are not really, for the most part, down my alley, but I still like just love all the imagination and all the hard work that went into those games, because I look at those and I'm like, you know, most of those aren't for me, but I can see that they're great. And I can see that, you know, if they had found the right audience, that system would have been huge.
I think we've talked about this before, but the thing I love about the Dreamcast the most and miss about it the most is it was Sega's voice. The way they voiced their games, the way they designed the logos and the style, it had Sega style that was completely unique to Sega. It came out on that system, and I really missed it. I wish they still had a Sega system where everything was Sega-like, you know, in that Dreamcast way, the Japanese sort of way. And it was great. I pre-ordered it on Amazon. This was very early sort of Amazon pre-ordering kind of stuff, and got it on, you know, $9.99, something like that. And boy, it was awesome. I played Sonic Adventure like crazy, so I had a good launch title. I loved Crazy Taxi and...
Crazy Taxi was the game I played most until Skies of Arcadia came out.
Yeah, I had that too. That was cool.
I don't think I got one when it came out. When did Spider-Man come out? The Neversoft Spider-Man.
I want to say that was 2000.
2000? Yeah, I think the next year. One almost specifically to play Spider-Man because it looked so much better on Dreamcast than it did on PlayStation. And Tony Hawk 2, which Tony Hawk 1 came out in 99. But that was my Dreamcast thing. And then I went back and got Space Channel 5, which was a 1999 release, or 1999 release. And I love Space Channel 5. I think Space Channel 5, by the standards of rhythm games, is not in depth. It's it's just, you know, it's basically Simon, but with anime.
But it's so fun.
And Michael Jackson. I love Space it. Michael. Thank you.
And Space Michael. Michael, yes.
And the soundtrack to Space Channel 5 is that
fantastic,
beautiful. Like, there was a real we talked about that Fantastic Four game that had that kind of funk soundtrack. In the late 90s there was a big weird revival of like 70s style,
like, I mean, it's just, you know, the 20 year thing. You know, you had bands like D-Light and I can't even remember.
Does
who
D-Light have anything to say about Space Channel 5?
I don't know.
Were they in that? I
can't remember. No, they sued.
Right. That's right.
Because Lady Miss Keir thought that Ooh La La was based on her, uncredited. They lost that lawsuit, and that is why you don't hear a lot from D-Light anymore, unfortunately.
I see.
The groove is still in the heart.
The main theme was what, Mexican Flyer, wasn't it?
Yes. Which is like a 60s funk track. There's an interview I did with Tetsuya Mizuguchi, the producer and director of that game. That was about a year and a half ago, but it's in the Retronauts archive, so check that out. He talks about, you know, just getting Mexican Flyer in there and like the fact that he never got to meet the composer of it, which is very sad. But it was that really set the tone for that game.
I had the sound, like I think I bought an imported Japanese version of the soundtrack, nice. like two discs or something. And the last level soundtrack that starts off with just it's all a cappella, and it just starts off with the rhythm. And then the more people you save, the more people are joining into the last song. I still find that genuinely moving.
It's fantastic.
Space Channel 5 rules super hard.
I will second this. Yeah, I came into it later because, like, you know, I didn't have the Dreamcast, but so I eventually got the Part 1 and 2 port on Sony. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just so much fun. Like you said, it's very simple, but it's just got this joy to it.
I've never played it.
You should. It's really fun.
I'm not good at rhythm games. Yeah. I enjoy them, but I never beat Elite Beat Agents.
There are cheat codes in Space Channel.
But I ended up, because of the simplicity and because it was very easy to time everything to the music, on the beat. I 100%ed
nice.
Space Channel 5. I had Space Michael. I was on fire for the whole time. But I played it over and over because I loved the music. I loved the design. I think the last appearance in my life of Apollo Smile, the live action anime girl, wherever you are, hope you're doing well. But yeah, I love Space Channel 5.
All right, Ben and Jeremy are looking at us like we got to move on.
Instead their watches being checked. Yeah.
I was getting messages on my watch. I don't know about
that. I get messages. It's
you get messages numbers from the future.
Yeah.
And also, Sega Dreamcast did not do so well for Sega, and it's a shame.
Soul Calibur was great also awesome looking.
That's true.
That was Soul one Calibur. I was jealous of because I had, you know, there were 3D fighters on Sony and they did not look as nice as Soul Calibur.
Yeah, I mean, I picked that one up and then played it and it was like, oh, this looks great, but I guess I'm just not into fighting games anymore. Yeah, I picked up a Dreamcast on launch day kind of on a whim. I was at CompUSA, if you remember that, and they had a bunch and I was like, okay. And I bought it and... Then the same day Final Fantasy VIII came out, and that's what I played for the next 2 weeks. I'm a bad Sega fan, but I'm also a bad Nintendo fan because the N64 was kind of the thing that Nintendo was doing, that in Game Boy Color in 1999, and I was having a hard time connecting with games like Mario Party and Super Smash Brothers and Pokemon Snap and Mario Golf and Donkey Kong 64. You know, Hybrid Heaven, Castlevania, yeah. Superman 64. Why did we put that on there?
Oof. It's important.
Yeah. I just like the N64. I had some good times with a few of the games on there and it just kind of otherwise failed to connect with me. And you definitely saw that sort of reflected in the numbers because, you know, the NES was, I think, like 50 million units sold, and the Super NES was like 40, and then N64 was more like 25 million sold. Like, you started to see this really big drop-off.
Yeah, and I was part of that. I jumped ship from Super Nintendo to PlayStation.
Yeah, generation was dominated by the PlayStation anyway, right?
So. Yeah, I mean, a bunch of Japanese developers jumped ship from Nintendo at that point. Mm. So the...
Square, of course, being the huge one.
Well, I mean, N64 was basically not quite a non-entity in Japan, but it did not... do the numbers like the Super Famicom and before that the Famicom just dominated Japan more than any other system, but N64 was like meh. And everyone gravitated to Sony.
It was a weird console. They made mistakes like not going with optical media and having a bizarre controller shape that's sort of intellectually confusing. Just like, to look
why
at
am
it
I why am I caressing it? A stingray, what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great controller if you actually use it, but I think it's got that sort of elevator pitch problem where if you look at it and you've never played it before, you're like, what the hell is this? You know?
I think that's part of what they were going for with it. I think they were trying to be like so sophisticated and futuristic that you'd be like, what's happening? I mean, you look at the same time you had Virtual Boy and its controller was kind of forward thinking, but also a little weird because it had two D-pads and, you know, a few years later, you'd get dual analog controllers, but that didn't really exist at the time. So people were kind of like figuring out how should games work in 3D.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
I wish they had used like the Virtual Boy dual control setup on N64 because it would have made better use of it. But instead, you had, you know, playing first person shooters and using like the face buttons to strafe, which
thing that intrigued me at the time, being a computer graphics geek who was in college when this stuff was happening, is the fact that the Nintendo 64 was basically like a Silicon Graphics workstation, and like the menus for it were literally an SGI demo that like I had running in a computer lab somewhere, like almost exactly the same thing, just adapted to their thing. And so like that was cool, but then all these games that I wanted to play were over on PlayStation, so I didn't actually buy one. I played all the way through Mario 64 on my Sweet Mate's game.
I would say by 99 I was sort of souring on the N64 in general. I loved the N64 just because of the earlier games like Ocarina of Time, and which was 98, wasn't it? I don't remember. So and you know, Mario 64 and stuff, but I wanted so badly to love, like, say, Donkey Kong 64, for example, but that was just a collect-a-thon slog. I was really disappointed with that.
You'll never get the kids' votes.
Mario Golf is like, okay, whatever, sorry. Mario Party was cool. I enjoyed that, but it broke your sticks because it had too many rotating games.
Or the sticks broke your fingers.
Yeah, but everyone was complaining you wear out your stick because there were so many things where you had to rotate it rapidly. And Super Smash Brothers? What? That never went anywhere.
I have a conspiracy theory about the... Yeah. Not a conspiracy theory, but this is my weird theory about N64. I feel like...
I was wondering about the tinfoil hat you've been wearing.
Yeah.
I feel like the N64 was directed as... And I don't remember a lot of the marketing for the 64, because I am a Nintendo loyalist. I've been there... I've owned every Nintendo system... and I have a weird hatred for the Genesis that did not extend to the Dreamcast because I also love the Dreamcast. But, you know, I had the 64 and a Dreamcast, you know, 64 and a PlayStation, GameCube and a PS2. But I feel like the 64 was built to be a multiplayer console because if you look at that list of games, I mean, you know, there's four controller ports. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you look at that list of games, it's Mario Party, it's Smash Brothers, it's Mario Golf. It's and when you think about the big hits on the 64, the wrestling games were a huge deal.
They built the system with four controller ports. Like system had that before that I can think of. Four controller ports built into the console. Like, that was unheard of. It was definitely the dorm room system.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
There were a few.
And then you look at the
popular.
What?
Atari 5200.
Yeah, that doesn't count. No one
Atari
wanted that.
Atari 800.
But then you look at the single player games, and I'm the weirdo who doesn't like Mario 64, Ocarina of Time, or Majora's Mask. Like, I don't like them. I'm glad everyone else does. But, like, if you get past those, and again, part of that is because of my motion sickness.
Yeah.
But, you know, you look at the other single player games, and it's Donkey Kong 64, it's Quest 64, it's Castlevania, it's Superman 64. There's nothing there for... Meanwhile, on PlayStation, you can play Final Fantasy VII for 80 hours. That's when I got into JRPGs for the first time.
The Castlevania game on the Nintendo 64 is horrible. I was so incredibly disappointed by that game.
I wouldn't say horrible, just a mess.
Plus, I mean, we had already had Symphony of the Night. So after Symphony of the Night came out, that was where I was like thinking about games. Like, everything should be like this from now on because it's so awesome. But then you go back to the Nintendo 64 and you've got a little like crayon colored guy struggling to jump around a 3D mansion. Yeah. It's just not the same, you know?
It's so weird that Symphony of the Night is such a masterpiece, and then like the like major console games, like obviously Symphony of the Night had plenty of successors, but the major console games are like, I mean, Lords of Shadow is okay, but it's a completely different animal.
Yep. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Everybody in the car, so come on, let's ride to the liquor store around the corner. The boys say they want some gin and juice, but I really don't wanna be a buzz like I had last week. I must stay deep, cause talk is cheap. I like Angela, Pamela, Sandra, and Rita. And as I continue, you know they're getting sweeter. So what can I do? I really beg you, my lord. To me, flirting is just like a sport. Anything fine, it's all good. Let me jump in, please sing in the trumpet. A
little bit. Yeah, but you know, Nintendo could look at this and say, we don't care that you don't like our N64 games, because you know what we've got? We've got Pokemon Gold and Silver, you little assholes.
Mm-hmm.
And those games sold a lot of copies.
Yeah,
and Pokemon
really
Yellow also. I guess Gold and Silver only came out in Japan in 99.
Yeah.
But like, you know, as soon as it started to show up at trade shows and that sort of thing in Japan, the American press was all over it because Pokemon had launched here in late 98 and was immediately a massive success. So, you know, we had like a year and a half of Pokemon Gold and Silver on the cover of magazines and, you know, extensive blowouts because people, you know, they knew kids wanted to know more about Pokemon.
Yeah. And the famous Iwata, like the 12 labors of Satoru Iwata, like rearranging the code so that they could fit all of Kanto into Gold and Silver. Like, imagine if at the end of Mario 2, you had to play through Mario 1 again. Like, it's backwards. It's a really, really good game, and the improvements that it made over the, you know, Red, Blue, and did Yellow come out in 99 here?
Yeah.
Like, Yellow, you know, you had Pikachu with you, which was great, but the improvements that the Gen 2 games made, in addition to, like, setting the standard of, oh, hey, we're just going to introduce a bunch of new ones. Like, oh, do you have them all? Great, here's 100 new ones that you can get. Brilliantly executed with Gold and Silver, I think.
Yeah, there's different genders for Pokemon, day-night cycle.
The day-night
cycle.
A lot of
stuff. That
breeding became a thing with genders being introduced, so a lot of really good stuff.
Yep. So that was kind of Nintendo's saving lifeline, but man, how are we going to get through all of Sony's stuff in the 10 minutes we have left to record? Good Lord, look at all these games. 1999, Sega, that was, you know, as 1989 was for the NES, 1999 was for the PlayStation.
Yeah.
I mean, it was indomitable. There was nothing bigger in the world. And it remains one of the absolute best-selling systems, just like Game Boy, because like everyone had a PlayStation. It was cool and fun and interesting. And wow, the library. Look at this.
Yeah, I mean, both all the developers converging on it, and you had, you know, weird, quirky stuff coming out of Japan making it over too. And so
and Sony was like, let's leverage the inexpensive nature of CD-ROMs and sell these weird quirky games for half the price of a major blockbuster title. So people will be like intrigued and say, well, okay, I'll pick up Parappa the Rapper for $20-$30. Why not? Mm-hmm. I'll pick up Bushido Blade for $20-$30.
Incredible Crisis. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, just the list here, Silent Hill, Final Fantasy VIII, Ape Escape, Persona 2, Legacy of Kain: Soul Reaver, Resident Evil 3, Rayman 2, Tony Hawk Pro Skater, Crash Team Racing, Valkyrie Profile, a bunch of Army Men games, Tomb Raider, The Last Revelation, Dino Crisis, Medal of Honor, Incredible Crisis, Silent Bomber, Kodolka, Gran Turismo 2, Legend of Mana in Japan, Chrono Cross in Japan, Vib Ribbon in Japan, The Misadventures of Tron Bond, Chocobo's Dungeon 2, Chocobo Racing, Airgeits, Final Fantasy Anthology, Saga Frontier 2, Spyro 2. There's other stuff, but good lord. And I think was 99 when they introduced the DualShock controller? Yeah, because Ape Escape. So that was that was where you finally got a proper modern video game controller with dual analog and haptic feedback.
Oh, yeah. Although I think the first one was the
dual analog.
Didn't have
no,
vibration.
No shock.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. And that was 98, but no one picked that up.
Yeah,
it was very short-lived. So, but there weren't any games that made use of it. Like Ape Escape was the first game that really
wasn't it. They had this analog like flight stick, dual flight stick controller for some kind of robot game or something. First, that was their first analog controller for the PlayStation.
There were a couple of games that used dual analog, but
yeah, so nothing
really took advantage of dual analog until Ape Escape, which was kind of used to launch the DualShock.
Yeah, I'm just saying, though, I think that the original dual analog controller before the DualShock was like their scaled down version of their big joystick thing. That's what they're aiming for. And then suddenly you could apply that to so many other games after that.
I haven't seen that one. The first dual analog that I know of is the same as the DualShock, but it looks very slightly different and doesn't have the rumble built in. Yeah. Like the DualShock is just a better version of the dual analog. Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Picture of it.
I mean, certainly analog controls existed before this point. You know, you mentioned the Atari 5200, and on PCs you had all kinds of crazy analog flight sticks. I bought a Thrustmaster. Mm-hmm. Such a great name! Wow. just so I could play Descent, and I was still no good at it. But you know, just the fact. Oh, I also used it for like X-Wing and stuff, but.
This is what I'm talking about. Oh, PlayStation analog joystick.
I didn't realize those were analog.
Yep.
Wow, okay.
So I think it's designed for flight simulators.
Probably
and
like Ace Combat and that sort of thing.
So two big full-size joysticks.
I vaguely remember that thing, yeah.
Well, nobody in America had it. I think it was just a, you know, gosh, I don't know what games. Okay, list of games. Ace Combat 2 and 3, Ape Escape, Asteroids. Yeah. I mean, this is like games. Yeah.
Of the analog games.
Yeah.
All right. So let's pick one game a piece here from this amazing Sony list and talk about why it's amazing. Chris, I think that's going to be Tony Hawk Pro Skater for you.
Yeah. Tony Hawk was huge for me. Like, as a kid who was really super into like skateboarding culture and like looking at all the catalogs at the boards and stuff, but had the athleticism and coordination of someone who really liked video games, like this was my way of experiencing skateboarding. And the first Tony Hawk game was fantastic for its time, and then there were like five good games that came after that, and then nothing else. Like nothing else came after Tony Hawk's Underground 2. I don't think no games were released, but the idea of that's the first game that I can remember having like real songs in the soundtrack, and maybe it was Tony Hawk 2, but like you're playing that game and listening to Public Enemy, like that's so cool. Like it felt like it felt like that late 90s like cool teen culture distilled into a video game.
I went to parties. I guess in 99, that was my last year of high school or when I graduated, and so I went to some parties in high school where people were playing that, or after high school or somewhere around that time. And they're all like, oh man, it's so awesome. Tony Hawk Pro Skater. And I wasn't into that scene. So
yeah.
Also, it's a good game though.
I also really liked the simplicity of building the controls the way they did, where you had, you know, one button for Ollie and then button for kick flips and kickflip related tricks, button for grab tricks. And the triangle was for grinds, which made sense. Cause it was like a little arrow pointing forward. And depending on which direction you were pushing and for the grinds, like what your orientation was, you would do different things. And so you could have this incredible variety of stuff, which in turn led to the, you know, the ridiculous high scores for doing varieties of tricks. Like, it was a really engaging game to play that encouraged you to play it in a specific way that was the most fun way to play it. Like, you couldn't just, you know, kickflip for like 3 minutes. You had to do cool stuff. And that philosophy eventually would get way out of hand. But at the time, like, Tony Hawk 2, choice games. Tony Hawk 3, I think, had Spider-Man in it, so that was cool.
Radical.
She's into superstitions, black cats and voodoo dolls. I feel a premonition, that girl's gonna make me fall. She's into new sensations, new kicks in the candlelight. She's got new addictions for every day and night.
Good. Why don't you tell us what your top game on the 1990 PlayStation list is?
All right, so man, what to do here? There's lots of good stuff, but you know, we all know about Final Fantasy VIII, so let's go down to the smaller stuff. I could talk about Incredible Crisis, which is just this incredibly weird collection of video games, but I'm kind of drawn to Misadventures of Tron Bonne.
Okay, do it.
So we'll do Tron Bonne, because this was so sort of a spinoff of Mega Man Legends.
Which was a spinoff of Mega Man.
And I actually didn't pick up Mega Man Legends when it came out, because it just looked, you know, it didn't look like it
was... That cover did not sell itself.
The cover didn't sell it, and it just, like, you know, I saw some videos, and it just, I wasn't sure Mega Man in 3D was really going to work. You know, at this point, I've gone back, and I like it, but... It was kind of a hard sell, but then we had Tron Bonne, and there was just, you know, it sort of took the same engine, but put it in, it's not trying to be a Mega Man game anymore, trying to be its own thing, and it's this collection of stuff, and you've got this cool, like, you know, pirate mechanic girl with her army of little robots that you can do stuff with. You can throw them at things and have them attack it, or throw them into little holes and have them grab treasure for you, and it just keeps mixing it up. You know, it's got these different mini games, it's got box games, but they make sense because they're kind of in this port sorting, like cargo, and... And it's just, it was different from anything else that was out there at the time. You know, it was in this whole genre of exploring what can we do with a 3D action game, but it just tried a lot of cool ideas at once. And unlike a lot of games that were like going out on a limb, trying weird new 3D ideas, this one worked for me. It's just a lot of fun. So if you get, is it, do we have a good way to access Tron
Bonne
now?
Yeah, it's on PSN.
It's like PSN
$6.
Now. Yeah.
Which is a lot better than buying it on eBay for $250.
Right, exactly. So yeah, if you have never tried it out and that didn't interest you at all, go pick it up for $6 on PSN. It's a lot of fun.
Okay, my pick is Crash Team Racing.
Really?
That's the only game out of this list that I played for more than an hour.
Yeah. Did you not own a PlayStation at the time?
Chrono Cross. I liked that game.
Yeah, although Chrono Cross didn't hit the US till 2000.
Yeah,
with
I
the whole
did,
summer
but
adventure.
I was still in love with Symphony of the Night, so I could not get over the crappy polygon graphics of the PlayStation. Like, those 3D games were just so jaggy, and I was still using a TV from 1983 that was passed down through the family, so it looked like crap on the TV anyway. So I couldn't get into that kind of thing. But
I sympathize with that.
Crash Team Racing is a very good Mario Kart clone for the PlayStation. And it plays well, and the tracks are well designed, and it's really fun. And that's why I think I played that game more than a lot of these other games that I probably tried a few of them, you know. You know, sorry. Gran Turismo 2 was cool, you know, but it was also hard because it was a simulation game. So
yeah.
It wasn't arcade.
It's not meant
style.
To be playable. It's meant to be, like,
difficult.
A discipline nerds. That you take upon yourself and... learn to master through Zen or something. I don't know. It's really strange.
I can see that. Yeah.
So actually I am going to talk about Chrono Cross because I did play it and beat it in 1999. Cause that was where I was at that point in life. That was a huge game for me. Just in a lot of ways, but
I remember it on Toasty Frog.
Yeah. Like, it was just an enticing looking game. It had this beautiful graphical style and the music was incredible. And I don't know why, but I just fell immediately in love with Chrono Cross, and I imported it, and I forced myself to play through it in with my very, very meager Japanese literacy, despite the fact that it is an extremely sort of abstract game. And, you know, I actually figured out what you have to do to get the true ending. Once I beat it, I was like,
which is impressive.
You know what? I feel like that thing that was happening during the final battle was something that ties back to another thing that I remember, but I don't remember the specifics. So I put out a call for help on like a forum or something, and people were like, oh yeah, yeah, you need to do it in this order. But I did at least, you know, kind of like deduce my way through the game, and I wrote a fac on it.
I remember getting us all hyped for it a year before it came out.
I was such a bad person. That was my first professional video games gig too. Like GameSpot. Actually, I think it was videogames.com at the time. Said, hey, we need someone to write a guide for Chrono Cross for us. Can we just republish your guide and we'll give you this amount of money? And I said, I'd feel kind of weird about just like giving you a thing that I did for free and getting paid for it, but I could rewrite the guide for you, which was stupid. I should have just said, okay, yeah, I'll take the money. But but I had this like weird sense of ethics. I don't know. It was dumb. So that was my first paying video games gig. And just you know, like through personal circumstances that set me on the road to where I am now, which I guess is good. So Chrono Cross is also a good game, but very sort of controversial. Not definitely not what people expected from a Chrono Trigger sequel, but yeah. I love it. Anyway, so PlayStation, wow, it was big. It was everywhere. It was inescapable. To wrap up 1999, we're going to skip 2009, sorry. I will say that for the first time, Nintendo had proper competition in the handheld space. No, just kidding. But there were some really cool handheld game, handheld systems released in 1999. In Japan, there was WonderSwan, which was the final creation of Gunpei Yokoi, mm-hmm. who created the Game Boy and Virtual Boy and Game Boy Camera and all kinds of cool stuff, Game & Watch. He was a great guy.
This was for Bonpei, right?
Bondi. There was a game called Gunpei, though. It was a tribute to him. Yes. And that showed up on, it's been on a bunch of systems, actually, PSP and DS and so forth. The WonderSwan launched as a black and white system in 1999 as a competitor to the classic Game Boy. And by that point, Game Boy Color had launched. So a few months later, they were like, just kidding. We're doing a color version. And SNK launched the Neo Geo Pocket, which was also launched as a black and white competitor to the original Game Boy in 1998. Mm-hmm. And SNK said, just kidding. Here's a color version. And I love that system. It is a great system with great games.
I do too. Yeah. I got it back then.
Yeah.
So I was excited for sort of a viable competitor to the Game Boy sort of thing. And it has a really cool stick.
It's a clicky, tiny
fighting stick that I did not know because I never had a Neo Geo CD. But apparently it's a sort of descendant of their Neo Geo CD controller that's sort of a miniaturized fighting stick with clicky, you know, directional.
So how long do you get out of the batteries on the Pocket Color?
It wasn't bad.
Is it pretty good?
That's pretty long because it's not backlit. You know, and it has a backup battery for like it saves your time.
Mm-hmm. Your calendar, it's got a horoscope built into it.
Yeah.
You get your fortune every day.
Nice. I didn't have one in 1999, but here's what your boy was really into in the turn of the century. It was the Sega Dreamcast and the Neo Geo Pocket Color. I swear I bought an NGPC. I don't know if it was the day before they announced they were discontinuing it, but it might have been that week. And I was like, oh, sweet, cool. But I did like it. Like it's also kind of a cute little system.
Yeah, it had fun stuff on it.
It had probably what I think was the first Sonic game that wasn't on a Sega console. Is that true? Like there was a Sonic 2D Sonic game.
I'm pretty sure Sonic Pocket Adventure was the first non-Sega platform Sonic game.
Yeah, and it was a cool game. I played that a lot.
I think it was developed by Dimps, who did the Sonic Sonic Advance games and a few others.
Yeah. So I played that, and I played... the cool thing is there was a Pac-Man port there for that, and which ordinarily would not be that exciting, but it came with this little restrictor ring that you could place into the joystick to make it four-way only.
So it was easily lost little piece of red plastic, but it turned the clicky stick like eight-way into a four-way, and it made Pac-Man really good.
That little detail of foresight and the thought they put into that design is incredible. That just, you know, it's amazing that you can do that.
That system deserved better, and it would have done better, but SNK was bought out by a pachinko company, Aruz, and they said, wow, you've got this little system with these great LCD screens. You know what these would be amazing for is our pachinko machines. So they killed the video game line, the Neo Geo Pocket Color line, and they basically took those parts and used them for their pachinko system.
This is like some evil,
it's really terrible. SNK went through some tough times after the 20th century came to an end, and they eventually have righted themselves.
Is pachinko fun?
No, but it's addictive.
It's straight up gambling.
It clicks the same part of your brain that works for slots.
It's a slot machine with more blinky things and like actual physical like little ball bouncy things going on.
The illusion of some control over the direction of balls.
But, pachinko is a kind of a recurring villain in the entire history of the video game industry. I mean, like we keep losing things to pachinko, but anyway,
this was one of the most heartbreaking. The Neo Geo Pocket Color was amazing, and someday someone is going to consoleize that or come up with like an HDMI out or something, and I am going to do Neo Geo Pocket Color Works
because awesome.
Damn it, that system is that so good.
30 games and a lot of them are fantastic.
It's about 80, and at least a tenth of them are pachinko games that I will do in one episode.
And I will build a joystick for this.
God bless.
Wild tale of a tornado running loose. You tie the noose, I kick the chair. I'm the cyanide that snatch your life while you gasp for air. The echo, echo, echo that boomerangs to hurt your loved ones.
All right, so are we going to really quick hit PC on that?
Okay, so to wrap up, 1999, there were some important PC games. Descent 3 is not important. EverQuest, however, is very important. One of the first big MMOs right after Ultima Online. Homeworld, which is important because Yes sang a song for it. Mugen is extremely important because it's like the doujin kind of fan game modding scene applied to fighting games. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the first sort of like big it was created as like an independent, like an almost like an emulation kind of thing, like throw your favorite characters together from any fighting game. It could take like resources from other games, you know, assets, and turn them into like fighting game characters that could face off against each other. It's still around, right?
It is around, but it feels like these days we have such ludicrous crossovers in officially licensed fighting games on all sides that it's almost redundant now.
A friend of mine said on Twitter the other day, he was like, hey, remember Mugen? I think it's just Smash now.
Yeah, well, it's Smash, and there's other things that, yeah.
Let's see, Omicron, the Nomad Soul, was important because it gave us David Cage, David Cage, but also it gave us David Bowie in a video game officially, which is that
which
is cool.
Which was pretty awesome.
I mean, he may not make good games, but David Cage has at least good taste in androgynous musicians.
We'll give him that.
System Shock 2 was extremely important, maybe not in terms of sales, but in terms of like design and innovation. We need to just have a System Shock episode someday. Mm-hmm. And Myth 2 Soulblader was important because it would erase your system.
But I want to... this is actually...
And blight your soul.
I'm going to pull rank I don't have and talk about this for just a second because Myth 2 is what I was on the Macintosh side. That is what I was playing for all of 1999. So this was a strategy game from Bungie. It's what they did in between back in the day when they were doing Marathon, their early 3D shooter, and when they got... merged with Microsoft and started doing Halo, they did Myth. And it was, I felt, a really groundbreaking strategy tactics game. You know, it didn't have the building. It was just you had the units at the beginning of the map that you were going to have and go and kind of micromanage them. But I liked it a lot. And if anyone wants to hear more about Myth, bug Jeremy to let me do a micro on it.
I think we should do one. Sure.
Because there's a lot to say about it, I think. But it was good times. And Myth 2 was sort of the refinement of the formula. It came out very tail end of 98. And I started running tournaments with it and stuff in 99. It was a good time.
All right. And finally, arcades actually kind of came back to life thanks to Beatmania and Dance Dance Revolution. They got each of those games got their second iteration and started to make their way over into American arcades. And all of a sudden, arcades became a place that people wanted to go again. That was kind of cool to go to because you could show off for your friends and like do crazy dances that you made up and acrobatics and stuff while you were playing DDR. There was also some other stuff. Street Fighter III Third Strike was, you know, is kind of considered like the pinnacle of that franchise in a lot of ways.
Really?
And yeah,
really,
yeah, absolutely.
People like Street Fighter 3 that much?
Third Strike. Yeah.
Third Strike, not Street Fighter 3,
Second Impact. But Third Strike is considered like peak 2D fighting.
Yeah, it has some amazing sprite work in it.
But also just like
where the hell was I then?
I don't know. Where were you?
I probably just blew it off because everyone loved Street Fighter 3 later. But
apparently
it's gorgeous.
You were playing Crash Team Racing.
I was playing old Nintendo games, still collecting retro games.
And finally, the notable thing for 1999 in arcades is that Billy Mitchell perfected Pac-Man.
Or did he?
Yeah, yeah, he did. I think he actually did that one.
Yeah, that one's for real.
Don't forget Jambo Safari, that crazy Sega.
Yeah, we talked about that in the Sega Arcade episode. So we've done. So yeah, there was a lot of stuff in '99. It was a good year.
And then in 2009. Everything happened.
Let's stay here for 10 hours.
No, but we have to go away today. Now. Nope. This is the end, beautiful friend. We'll revisit in 10 years and talk about 2009 in the context of another one of these episodes. So please look forward to that Retronauts episode, like 2000. I don't know, whatever it is. Anyway, thanks everyone for bearing with us and your patience as we ramble disjointedly about history in a very sort of disorganized way. It's very exciting. I'm glad you could be here with us for us. With us for it. Yes, that's it. You know what? I've got low blood sugar. I need to eat lunch.
It's definitely lunchtime.
Let's wrap this thing up. Hi, I'm Jeremy Parrish. You're listening to Retronauts. Probably, unless you gave up a little while ago. You can find Retronauts on the internet. Look for Retronauts. We're on Podcast One for a little while longer. You can support us through Patreon and get episodes a week early, patreon.com/retronauts. And we publish every Monday and then every other Friday. So that's very exciting. Yeah, guys, where else can we find you on the internet? Benj.
I am Benj Edwards, and right now I'm building joysticks at bxfoundry.com. By the time this episode comes out, my new website should be up with a shopping cart and stuff. So you can find me on Twitter at Benj Edwards. And Ben?
I'm Ben Elgin. You can find me on Twitter at Kirin. That's K-I-R-I-N-N. My Retro Closet blog is kind of on hiatus at the moment. I'll let you guys know if that gets resurrected at some point. I don't know that I have anything else to plug right now. I could plug my day job. If you need a desktop milling machine, check out Bantam Tools.
I do need one.
Well, there you go. All right.
Perfect.
Mm-hmm. I'm Chris Sims, and I'm really looking forward to coming back and talking about how, according to Jeremy Parrish, Bayonetta is retro now.
I'm sorry. That's the law. I don't make the rules.
No, I'm excited. I'm looking forward to it.
No, actually, I do make the rules. Okay, mm-hmm. Never mind.
You can find me on the BAB website as at the ISB. You can also find all of my stuff at the-isb.com. That has links to all of my podcasts and all the fun things that I do. I also wrote a bunch of comics in 2018. Don't have anything yet coming up for 2019 that I can talk about, but if you would like to hire me to write something, your boy has time. So hit me up.
And apparently Assassin's Creed 2 is retro now. That's also terrifying.
Yep, it sure is. 10 years. That's the boundary. So anyway, I'm sorry we couldn't reinforce your sense of mortality this week, but hey, there's always the future. So please join us again next week for another episode, and we'll be back talking at you soon. Strangling